Welcome back. This is Take Charge of Your Health with Corinne Frenari, clinical nutritionist and physician assistant, and my co-host, Carol Peterson, pharmacist. Every week, we present you with new and creative ways to help you make sense of health information and bring it home to you and your family. With years of clinical experience between us and research into traditional and cutting-edge technologies, we give you practical information to help you take charge of your health. Welcome back. Welcome back. Today we have a special show, and Carol will not be with us, unfortunately, today, but I asked Dr. Tom Lewis to be with us. There is so much to learn. It's a total understanding of health that many of us and most of the practitioners do not understand. And so today we're going to be going over this with Dr. Lewis, and I'm very much looking forward to it. I've just been riveted to his writings and to his talks. And so now we will share it with you. Dr. Lewis, are you there?
I am. Thank you so much.
Oh, well, thank you for sharing this time with us. I'm so impressed by your thoughts and your patterns of thinking of health and wellness, and I just couldn't wait to share it with the audience. So could you begin by telling us about yourself and your relationship to health?
Well, you know, I have to give credit where credit is due. And I give all my praise to my mentor at Harvard Medical School, Dr. Clement Tremp, who was an ophthalmologist there for 47 years. And he taught me everything I know today, really, in so many ways, or at least pointed me in the right direction. My backstory is I have a doctorate in chemistry from MIT. I went to the Harvard School of Public Health and studied nutrition in the public interest and toxicology, but when my dad passed of Alzheimer's 20 years ago, I'd already been interested in the disease, but really didn't have a direction. But I went to an MIT Enterprise Forum meeting, and I was introduced to Dr. Tremp, who as an ophthalmologist was reversing dementias well before I met him. And how is that possible? Because
exactly.
he was the only eye doctor, and to this day, the only eye doctor that really used the eye as a window to your health. I mean, the eye is cliche, the window to your soul, but so many aspects of the eye tell you what's going on in your brain. The eye is actually an embryological outcropping or part of the brain. There's another very fancy chaired professor at Harvard by the name of John Dowling, and he wrote a very intense book, not really for the layperson, called The Retina, the approachable part of the brain. So what Dr. Tremp was doing way back when was using the eye as a screening tool to affect systemic treatment of eye diseases, particularly glaucoma, macular disease, and cataract. And patients were coming back, not really to his surprise, and saying, you know, my loved one or myself, our brain seems to be functioning a whole lot better. And, of course, he could substantiate that the eye was functioning a whole lot better because the eye being transparent, a lot of the instruments that eye doctors have, ophthalmologists or even optometrists, are extremely precise and accurate at measuring disease, much better than what, say, a cardiologist would have. Imagine if a cardiologist had a window into your heart. Your eye doctors do.
Well, they have a window. They can look in the eye and see circulation patterns, and they can, and capillaries, just as we all can, but they're not utilizing that. You can literally, through the eye, you can see hypertension also.
Absolutely. And so, you know, what I do in my program, and you know, I send people to eye doctors that I think have a clue and have them get, you know, a slit lamp microscope, a fundus camera to look for macular disease, and a optical coherence tomography or OCT to look at the retina, which is really the closest surrogate to the brain that we have in any part of our body. And then I interpret it for them. I tell them, don't go to your eye doctor and tell them you want to get screened for Alzheimer's, because they might get a racing stripe in their pants, if you know what I mean. That's not what they're afraid to do that.
So what would you look at in the eye, and how would you even begin to evaluate that?
Well, I've been doing this for 15 years, so that's an easy question for me. My mentor was doing it long before that, but you know, I just have the eye doctor look for the big three eye diseases and have make available to me all their scans. But see, MRI and OCT use the same technology, except OCT is for the eye and it's much more precise. And you look at what's called the retinal nerve fiber layer, and you can see very accurately if that nerve is deteriorating. Let me just give you an example of why this is important. There's a big study about 10 years ago at Mass General looking at people with mild cognitive impairment. And when they came in and did MRIs on the brain, they found out that even at the mild cognitive impairment stage, these people had on average 15% atrophy in the brain. So it's already late stage when you have mild cognitive impairment. But we can see that the deterioration of the eye at the very earliest stage.
And what would we see?
So we're seeing with tomography, just like with MRI, we're seeing images that measure very precisely the thickness and volume of that tissue.
Okay.
So we can measure that very accurately. Now let me just, you know, we haven't got into causes, and this is what everybody's wondering about, but what my mentor, Dr. Tremp, showed, you know, if you look at the proximity of your mouth, particularly your upper jaw, to your eyes and to your brain, they're sitting right on top of each other. And people with root canals have much, much higher Alzheimer's disease than people without. And another colleague of mine, Judith McClosey, out of Switzerland, MD, PhD, published a paper that basically said types of infections out of the mouth called spirochetes, which are very similar to the same thing that causes Lyme disease, drive the Alzheimer's process. The name of her first paper in 1993 was called Alzheimer's, a Spirochetosis. Translated, that spirochetal diseases or infections in the brain can elicit the response that we call Alzheimer's. Now, it's not the only cause, and why do some people have it and others don't? Well, that goes directly back to what's wrong with our medical system today, and that is that we do not measure disease very carefully or accurately in the standard of care with their blood tests and examinations. You know, a diagnosis is a line between health, good health, and poor health. But really, it's not a line. It's a continuum. And our whole approach is we say and we measure very accurately, where do you lie on the health disease continuum? And a diagnosis is just an artificial point along that line. And my objective is to get everybody who I work with farthest on the good side of that line of demarcation and continuum as possible. And see, a lot of people have like a little emerging symptom. They say, no big deal. The next thing they know, have a big event. Yeah. You know, we want people to be more proactive. And I don't call this prevention, because that's prevention is sort of a dirty word in health. No one wants to do prevention. I call it optimization. So, you know, there's no such thing as healthy or sick. Somewhere in the globe is the healthiest person. Somewhere in the globe is the unhealthiest person. And the rest of us are somewhere in between. And obviously we want to endeavor to be as close to the healthiest person on the planet as possible. And you don't do that by walk around and saying, I'm okay. You know, we have to measure, if you're not testing, you're guessing, and get you on a further better side of good health than you currently are. So that's not prevention, that's optimization.
Exactly. But what tools? The tools become difficult, because I know I do blood tests And I literally have to reinterpret the blood test according to what I want. Because when I began and when I was trained, let's just give this example. Testosterone was 450, a range of 450 to 1200. Now 1000 is out of range and 250 is normal. So they've shifted the ranges on us as our population is getting older. So our blood tests, they exist today. And how would you like to be 260 and be normal? Or be 990 and be normal? How are you going to feel at 260 and you're still in a normal range?
Right. You know, so what we've done, I was just in Dr. Tremp's office. So, you know, this was 18 years ago. And he goes to me, he goes, Tom, the only thing that really matters is mortality. And I'm saying, I wonder what he means by that. And then I thought about it. And I looked up, because both of him and Dr. McCulley, another colleague of mine at Harvard, was saying, you know, just what you said, Corrine, is that there were the lab normal ranges used to be tighter. And so I went to lab test online, and you go to Mayo Clinic and all these and just look up what reference ranges mean. And they say three things, which are absolutely absurd. Number one, you go to one lab or another lab, and the reference ranges could be different. So if it's the same human, but the reference ranges are different, I can go to LabCorp and be healthy, and I can go to Quest the same day and be sick. That is not a science-based system. Then the other two ridiculous things they say are a normal range does not necessarily infer health. And then the other thing they say is an abnormal value does not necessarily infer sickness. Once again,
the blood test?
Exactly. So I took that information and then what Dr. Tremp told me about mortality, and I did the following to create a true evidence-based scale based on laboratory biomarker values. And that what I did is I spent a lot of time at this a couple of years going into PubMed literature and overseas journals and everything and looked at where does a marker, when we look at various ranges for that marker, start indicating an increase in all-cause mortality. And then being an MIT scientist, I did a lot of curve fitting, and I've developed an entire scale of many, many biomarkers based on how they have an impact on early mortality. And then I did other studies that showed there's a direct correlation between dying young and having a lot more disease burden building up to that death. So in other words, we call it mortality and morbidity. So morbidity is disease states, and mortality is, you know, dying young. And so the younger you die, the worse your health is leading up to that death. So this scale is an objective science-based scale. I'll give you an example. White blood cell counts. Many different labs have many different reference ranges for white blood cell counts, but on average, it's like 3,500 counts of white blood cells per unit of volume of blood to 10,800. 10,800. But what we've showed is that if you don't want to be in the excess mortality zone, you want to be between 4,000 and 5,700. So look at how high 10,800 is. It's more than, almost double. It's crazy high. And so, and then you get the cholesterol, which everybody's on a statin drug. My mortality studies, which involved one case where they looked at population of 12.8 million people. My ranges for total cholesterol don't even overlap with what the standard of care has. Yep. I want you to be between 200 and 265 with ability to go higher depending on what your HDL value is.
Okay. 200 to what?
265.
I have people that come in at 200 and they're being told that their cholesterol is too high.
Well, you want to know why? Because even though statin drugs, even though statin drugs are off patent, they are still the number. There's been a $1 trillion gross sales in statin drugs with lots of profit. $1 trillion. That's a huge industry. And the statin drugs cause so many downstream diseases, like it increases diabetes. It increases heart failure. That's very well published. It increases sudden violent deaths like suicide because it messes with the brain. But the biggest thing would be, the biggest thing would be heart failure. And, you know, they advertise this Entresto drug, which is extraordinarily expensive. And in heart failure, it may extend life by 4 months. But many, many cases of heart failure are caused because of the action of one of the mechanisms of statin drugs.
Now, how about memory loss with statin drugs? Because
drastically
lower cholesterol. We need the cholesterol to be able to think.
Let me explain how simple this is.
Can I just stop you for 1 second?
Please
come join our conversation. The number to call is 212-209-2877. That's 212-209-2877. You can ask Dr. Lewis questions. You can join the conversation. We're going to ask you to make your questions short and so that we can get as many people as we can on the radio so they can hear the answer to the questions. Go on, Dr. Lewis.
Let me explain how simple the whole cholesterol thing is. First of all, there's no one on the planet that knows their cholesterol number because they don't measure it. Total cholesterol is a red herring. It's your low density lipoprotein value plus your high density lipoprotein value plus 20% of your triglycerides. Is there some cholesterol associated with the LDL and HDL? Yes, but there's also vitamin A, vitamin D, vitamin K, any of the fish, any fat you take in. See, let's go through a little experiment. So you have a greasy dish and you go to wash it by hand without soap. Does the grease come off? No, because oil and water or grease and water or fat and water do not mix. Look at a salad dressing, you know, with the oil on top and the water below. Your bloodstream is 92% water. How do all these fats we're consuming travel through a water-based bloodstream? And fats are this important. Fats in biology or physiology are called lipids. Every single membrane in your body, from bone to neurons to skin cells, are phospholipid bilayer. So lipids or fats are involved, are incorporated into every single cell membrane in our entire body. So how do they get through if oil and water or fats and water don't mix? How do these fats get to tissue through our water-based canal system? They get packaged into LDL to be transported out and then HDL to be transported back. Now I add soap to my water to clean the dish, and guess what? The grease magically comes off. Guess what substance LDL, the evil LDL, and the not-so-evil HDL are? They are soap molecules. They are simply a four-letter word, soap.
They're calling them the bad cholesterol versus the good cholesterol. I have a patient that had a 160 cholesterol, or LDL, and they brought him down to 110.
Well, you know, see, we have a medical system where the primary care doctor is just sort of a turnstile to specialists. And then the specialists don't speak to each other anymore. You know, it used to be that we had grand rounds, you know, doctors would talk to each other, but they don't anymore. Yeah. So there's an example of a paper published in the journal Neurology that shows that if you lower your LDL value to where the American College of Cardiology and the American Heart Association wants your LDL to be, your stroke risk goes up by 65%. Why? because stroke is either ischemic, where there's a blockage, or hemorrhagic, where there's a burst. Well, when you lower your LDL, you lower the ability to repair these vessels. So they're much more likely to burst, or I won't get into the ischemic aspect, but it plays a role in that as well. It's more graphic to understand the hemorrhagic component of stroke. And then if you get down to an even lower number, like below 50 for LDL, your stroke risk goes up by 300%.
Really? And now this is not, these are not obscure journals. These journals are available.
Journal Neurology. The Journal Neurology is the top neurological journal for all, you know, it's the go-to journal. And then the study on that shows in the 12.8 million people that you want to be between 200 and 265 was published in the journal Nature, which is one of the top three scientific medical journals of all time. So that's not a fringe journal published out of, I don't want to disparage anybody, but let's just say, you know, Iraq.
The number to call, 212-209-2877. Now, I know we've started this, but let's put it into context. What is the hierarchy of health? And you talk about a four-level continuum. Can you explain that to us?
I publish four levels just for convenience, but really the hierarchy is multi-level. So let's just give you an example. You're building a house. Well, what's the most important thing? The foundation, right? Because everything else is going to be built up on top of the foundation. And then you have the scaffolding, the studs, I'm blanking on the word. And then the sheathing, and then the wiring, and then, you know, you go down further and further to finish the roof and the framing, the framing, and you keep going down lower and lower and lower. Well, does the roofing material matter if your foundation is on shaky ground? Not so much. That's what the hierarchy of health is. It's a logical, what I call, systems approach to improving health. And, you know, we hear the words diet and exercise ad nauseum. But, you know, there's an old slogan, you are what you eat. In the hierarchy of health, we say that's not that important. It's important, but it's not the most important. You are what you absorb. And I would say, particularly in America today, that some level of gut dysbiosis, which means you're not absorbing well, is the most prolific syndrome, underappreciated syndrome. A lot of people have mild symptoms and don't appreciate how profound it is. And this is why it's profound. You have 3.5 hours to liquefy anything for it to be absorbed through the intestines, into the bloodstream. Okay? Sugars, throw sugar in water, dissolves immediately. So a low-value processed fast foods, things of that nature. But take a piece of kale and throw it in water, and 3.5 hours later, it's not even soft. You've extracted nothing from that. And what the kale has, as opposed to the low-value empty calories, is it has the nutrients which are like, you know, the carpenter's building that house on top of a solid foundation. And so you have to have a very robust digestive system to get value out of your nutrients. That's why digestion is even more important than what you eat, because if you eat well and your digestion's poor, your physiology sees junk food equivalent. So digestion is number one.
What we see is one of the number one over-the-counter pharmaceuticals are digestive aids. They're for constipation, they're for diarrhea, they're for digestion, they're for gas. And yet people want to eat what they want to eat, even though it makes them feel ill.
You know, Prilosec and those other ones of that class, It's absolutely evil that those are over the counter, because the label, when the doctors were prescribing it, even though they didn't pay attention to the label, was very clear. No more than 14 days, three times a year. Why? Because you get addicted because of what's called rebound syndrome to these drugs. But they should never be taken. And here's why. Reason why you get heartburn is you are not digesting rapidly. You're digesting slowly. And so slow digestion, a synonym for that is fermentation. And so what happens is when you digest slowly, you ferment, you create gas. And then your stomach's kind of a closed system, so the liquid goes to gas, there's great expansion, there's pressure, you might feel bloating, and then eventually it pops the little sphincter valve that separates the stomach from the esophagus, and some liquid or gas or mist comes up your esophagus. It can cause esophageal tightening, it can cause eroding teeth, or it can cause the classic heartburn. So what the Prilosec and these other over-the-counter drugs do now is they make your stomach acid even weaker. So you're no longer fermenting, you're fermenting so slowly that your system absorbs the gas and you don't have that reflux scenario. But what you really should be doing is strengthening your acid so you can break down proteins quickly, so you can break down foods more quickly, so you can kill any pathogen you're swallowing. I mean, people with a little bleeding gum and they're swallowing, where do you think those pathogens are going into your gut? What keeps them from proliferating throughout your body? Strong acid kills them on contact, whereas a lot of people who have diarrhea or cycling between diarrhea and constipation, that's called SIBO, small intestinal bacterial overload. How did the bacteria get into the small intestine? Because the stomach acid is inadequate. And
job.
So little organisms that you might swallow or come in with the food can now don't get killed, and they can migrate down the digestive tract and then disrupt. You know, I call it, you know, it's more complicated than this, but I say you have digestion, absorption, elimination. And those are the basic three major systems in the gut. And so the SIBO, the small intestinal bacterial overload, will affect reformation of the stool and affect diarrhea, or not break down food enough so you have more particles going down and cause a backup in that way, constipation.
Now, we're talking about a different way of looking at health, a different way other than what they would call our allopathic or traditional health care. What do you think the shortcoming of the traditional health care is? And I'm also going to give out the number again, 212-209-2877. Dr. Lewis?
Well, simply put, it's a sick care system. It's designed around treating acute conditions. Our system's very good at dealing with broken legs and acute immediate injuries, but the problem is most diseases are chronic. This is per the CDC, and it says 90% of diseases are chronic. These matriculate slowly. I always tell a little sad joke. You don't catch Alzheimer's. You might catch a cold, but you don't catch cardiovascular disease. You caught it many, many moons ago and just didn't realize that it's just slowly matriculating in your body. So we have a system where we do some very parochial testing, which aren't very informative, particularly when the scales are wrong. And then to go to your doctor and say, I'd like to get a more advanced test, they say, well, I can't do that test without a diagnosis. So in other words, you already have to be way down the disease process to have something diagnosable before they can even start figuring out what's causing it. And by then, like I explained with mild cognitive impairment and the study at Mass General Hospital at Harvard, is but when you have mild cognitive impairment, you don't even have a diagnosis yet. You already have 17%, 15% atrophy in your brain, and you don't even have a dementia, unto which the the medical establishment then starts taking action. So in a five-letter word, you're screwed.
Well, they always, allopathic healthcare system always talks about evidence, evidence-based medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And so how does this differ? How they always try to stop us from treating patients because it doesn't have evidence.
So we now know that a lot of trials are corrupted, and what they base their evidence on are so-called randomized controlled trials. But you have to realize most interventions are pharmaceutical. And if you just do a Google search, or maybe Google won't give you that anymore, go to Brave and do a search and say, ask a very basic question. When a pharmaceutical company does a randomized clinical trial, do they have to present all their data to the FDA to get that drug approved? And you will very easily find that the answer is no. So if they don't have to present all the data, what data are they holding back? You know? And then when we talk about evidence, when we look at the fact that the most foundational piece of evidence is laboratory data. And if you can go to one lab and on the same day go to another lab and have different reference ranges, so in one lab you're considered healthy and one lab you're considered sick,
efficient.
How dare they call that an evidence-based system? How dare they? So I have a friend, he's an optometrist friend of mine who worked with me and Dr. Tremp, who really coined the term evidence-biased medicine. And what he really means is that the evidence presented is cherry-picked or biased by the agenda of those paying for the studies. And so, the system I've built based on early mortality risk, I can argue the evidence discussion with any doctor, the highest level, Fauci, Mr. Science, or anybody, and embarrass them when they go to justify their evidence. They will just say, this is what the randomized controlled trial said. That's what we base it on. But, we don't have all the data on the randomized controlled trial. I tell you what, Mr. Evidence-Based Person, let's go back, Freedom of Information Act, and get every last piece of data from that study, and more importantly, all the follow-on studies, to see if your so-called evidence-based conclusions hold water. And I can guarantee you, look at Vioxx, killed at least 60,000 people, okay?
Whoa.
And that was after 5 years of study and randomized controlled trials for safety and efficacy. How'd that work out? And then iatrogenic deaths, which is the number three cause of death behind heart disease and cancer, are medically induced errors. And the major cause of those deaths really are the fact that these pharmaceuticals are not safe and effective. We won't even discuss effective, but just the fact that that's number three on the list shows you how tenuous that these drugs can be in terms of just a slight mess up in a prescription can cause someone to die. Never mind that Stanford has this database that shows that on average, the average pharmaceutical has 300 side effects. That's not me. That's Stanford. Stanford University, Stanford Medical School has developed this database.
Now we have some callers on the line.
Fabulous.
And I'm going to go right to the caller. Hello, you're live on BAI. Your
hello.
Name, please.
Hello, Corinne. Can you hear me?
Yes, I certainly can. Hi.
Hi, good afternoon. Another good show. May I know the Dr. Luce's first name?
Tom.
Thomas.
Thomas, okay. Dr. Luce, I had cataract surgery in both eyes, which was successful. The first one was about 15 years ago. But now that eye sees an image of about one-third larger. It's the right eye. And it sees the image is about one-third larger than the left eye. And it's also, when I look at straight lines, they're wavy. And I was told it was something to do with the retina. Usually it has a dip in it, but now it doesn't have a dip in it. And so I'm looking for a diagnostic label and what treatment.
You know, that's interesting. First of all, how old were you 15 years ago?
87, 72.
Okay, so you're you've done well.
Pardon me? Yeah.
You've done well. So you know, 72 getting a cataract is not so bad as 60 and getting a cataract. People who get cataracts earlier on, it tends to be sort of an infectious inflammatory process rather than some sort of secondary process with just aging. So that's a concern. But the fact that you were 72 is reasonably okay in terms of health prognosis. But the waviness, you know, are you in the New York area?
Yeah, Astoria.
Yeah, I hate to tell you, but I'm a former Bostonian, okay? But, you know, there we go. So everybody's about to hang up, but that's harder. What can I tell you? But there's a optometrist in the New Jersey area by the name of Kerry Gelb, and he's one of the top optometrists in the country. He runs this program, an association called All Docs, OD, and getting a full evaluation from someone like that. See, I'm not an eye doctor.
Uh-huh.
I interpret eye data in the context of what a cataract could potentially mean in terms of risk of early death, disease, things of that nature, glaucoma, things like that. But, I don't look at scans every day. So someone like Kerry Gelb or one of his members of his association, another good association of eye doctors is Vision Source, so visionsource.com. That's a unified sort of trade group of optometrists that go through more advanced training. And rather than just like your optometrist in the box at Walmart or places like that, that could probably give you better insight into that. It's just, see, what you have, I don't believe would fit in my kind of motif of pathologies that are going to cause you to die younger. That's what my main focus is. So I use the eye as a screening tool to look for early signs of early mortality indicators. And I think you just have something locally going on in the eye rather than some sort of systemic manifestation.
And could you give me the name of that optometrist again in New Jersey, and where is he located in New Jersey?
Oh, you're gonna have to look up the location, but I think it's sort of central, north central. His name is Kerry, K-E-R-R-Y.
Got that.
G-E-L-B. Kerry Gelb.
G-E-L-B.
B, yeah. Mm-hmm. And he is, you know, he's into ocular nutrition, all the kinds of things, all things eyes that could potentially test and then reverse this kind of eye-focused, if I can use that play on word, eye-only, eye-focused disease.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you for your call. Hi, you're live on BAI. Your name, please.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm calling from Brooklyn. My name is Mitch. I would like to know if anything can be done about diabetic neuropathy in the eyes, when you're using your eyes through the diabetic.
Yeah, see, that's
neuritis.
At the end of the day, that's a microvascular disease caused by an inflammatory process that the sugars are causing. You know, and usually we can see that in the eye before it manifests. Say, do you have any swelling in your lower extremities, ankles, and feet, anything like that?
No, I don't know. No.
That's good. That's good. So it hasn't progressed to that extent. But there are eye drops, but see, the whole thing is to fix that condition in the eye, you got to realize the eye is the most energetic tissue in the entire body. Just think about, you know, your eye is really teeny, okay? Just the statistics on that is the retina is 1/10,000th the size of your brain. Yet when you close your eyes, you feel a relief from fatigue, you know? That's how energetic your eyes are. So what I'm getting at is the eyes are extremely vascular and extremely metabolically active. So sometimes a lot of these vascular and metabolic conditions will show up in the eye first because the eye is so dependent on energy and good blood flow. But the solution to your problem is your whole body. It's getting a dietary change, getting you on an anti-inflammatory process. And then in a lot of cases, do you have any root canals, sir?
No, I don't have any root canals.
Well, that's good.
I need teeth.
A lot of times infectious species come into play and will calcify those microvessels. And so treatment of that or treating you with anti-calcification agents, you know, high doses of magnesium. There's a product called Atiracil or Endocalyx Pro, which is designed to open up the vessels. There are supplements and even foods like beets that increase nitric oxide in your blood vessels, which help dilate those vessels and get better blood flow. But ultimately, there's probably an overhaul in your dietary approaches, where we lower insulin and your glucose levels, which will have the most profound effect on the eye condition. See, everything's being amplified in your eye because your eye is so metabolically active.
What does root canals? You asked about root canals, dentists.
Right.
What might that have to do with it? What?
Well, because the root canal, the mouth is right next to the eye, and root canals often, you can't feel it because the nerve is dead, but root canals often can be loaded with infectious things that can potentially get into the eye because they're right next door to each other and create an inflammatory process. And when you have inflammation that causes the vessels to constrict, or calcify or otherwise not allow blood to flow as well. And see, neuropathy is really, it's a blood flow issue first that then affects the nerves. So that's why the root canals play a role in that.
Because what they've been doing, I go to the doctor, type of shots in the eye, and you know, I can't see for a couple of days.
Those shots are not good. They're called, it's called Lucentis or Avastin. They're called anti-VEGF. See, what they're doing is they're trying to stop the new vessel growth in your eye because it blocks your vision a little bit. Not a lot, but a little bit. But see, the difference between someone who, you know, I may be running away from the eye here, but believe me, it's all connected. The difference between someone who dies suddenly of a heart attack and then someone just has sort of a mild heart attack but survives is your body builds collateral bridges around any blockage. But what they're doing in the eye, if I'm guessing right, is they're putting in this Lucentis substance. It's an eye needle injection, and that literally stops new vessel growth throughout your entire body. And even on the label, it'll tell you that in a case like you, you're 360% higher likelihood of dying in 2 years than someone who's not getting those injections.
Wow.
That's not me. That is on the package insert of the eye injection pharmaceutical. You know, if you open up the insert, it's very, very fine print, a fold-out document that's about 8 pages long, But buried in there somewhere is, so DBE, which is diabetic, I might have the initials wrong, but your condition is much higher increase in mortality when you're taking that drug. It's a bad deal.
So it would be very important that I would see that you would want to immediately begin to work on inflammation and
absolutely.
See if you could get your insulin down. And
yep.
I love a very concentrated curcumin, which would help the inner lining, the endothelium of the arteries and the capillaries. You want to get that inflammation down. Ginger also, and boswellia. But there's also some mushrooms that work to slow down the revascularization, and that's a coleus, and it's a specific.
You might be interested, Corrine, to know that you know I have one cup of Java every day, and I put turmeric, cayenne pepper, and ginger in my coffee every day, and cayenne pepper has actually been shown to reduce blood pressure.
Perfect.
Oh, okay.
So I want to thank you for your call. You can call us back and tell us how you're doing. This is going to take a little work. You know, Dr. Thomas Lewis said something very specifically about the name of his group. The name of his group is what... Revitalize
Health
Revival. And what the important part is that there's two people working together, the medical practitioner and the patient. And right now we've given you a few things to work on.
Okay.
So give us a call back.
Oh, thank you. Appreciate
and
it.
Let us know how you're doing. I think there's one more person. Hello? You're live on BAI, and thank you for holding.
Mike,
maybe
check.
Not.
Hello?
Pardon? Hello?
You're on the air, caller. Speak at any time.
Hello? 212-209-2877.
Mike, check.
212?
Anytime,
yes?
Caller. You're on the air.
Okay. Can you hear me? Corrine.
Yes. Hello.
Peace and blessings. This is
Forrest
Nance. Yes. Thank you. Peace and blessings. Dr. Lewis, wonderful presentation. I love what you put out there in your presentation, sir. Quick question. And by the way, Corrine, maybe you'll send the gentleman to John Monroe. You get more information from John.
That's a little different. That's a little different because
what he's talking about is
John Monroe has to – in terms of vision, it's different. So go on.
Okay, yes, ma'am. Dr. Lewis, since you're talking about blood, if I'm not off track here, I would like to know your take on Dr. Peter Adamo's book where it says, eat right for your type. I'm an A positive. And it says, don't eat bananas. I put bananas in my smoothie just about every other day. It never affects me. So I just wanted to know your take on that, Dr. Lewis.
That's a really interesting question, and I'll admit I'm not an expert on that, but I'm seeing a young lady who's going for her PhD who's an expert on blood type, and she gave me my list. I'm a B+. But see, I'm having a hard time with that concept as a scientist, and the reason is when you know we've been around for a long time, okay? And in the last two or three generations, we've been able to do blood testing and get this kind of information. But what about the other 500 generations we've been around? And we had no idea what our blood type was, and we ate what was available. So that's why I scratched my head over this. And you know, there's a concept called nutricogenomics, there's pharmacogenomics, and there's even what's called infecticogenomics. So That's a study of how your genes may or may respond to certain types of substances found in foods. And so there's something somewhat real there, but I'm not sure the blood type would be the most accurate way to determine whether you have reactivity to a certain food or not. And what I generally do as a rule of thumb to keep things simple is I say, how's your gut? How's your bowel movements? Are they regular? Do you have any rumbling in the tumbly? That kind of stuff. And you know, there's a lot, like Stephen Gundry's world famous for holding up a tomato. And he holds it up and he says, you think this is good for you? Think again. See, I think that's the absolute wrong message. We've been eating tomatoes for eons. He should be holding that tomato up and say, see this tomato? If it's causing you some kind of inflammation or digestive upset, then let me work with you to fix your digestion so that's no longer the case. Because ultimately, let me give you an example. If I took some chicken and extracted the protein and injected it with a needle under your skin, there's a good chance you're going to have an allergic reaction. But if you eat that chicken and the chicken protein gets into your gut and you break it down to fundamental substances, amino acids, and there's only 20 of them, your immune system totally recognizes those 20, whether it came from a chicken, a plant, whatever, then you're going to have no distress from that. So my focus is always, do we get into the weeds like eat for your blood type, or do we work on the foundational issues like is my gut actually optimal or not, and what can I do to get it there, and then see what's still out there. But the fact that you're not responding to the bananas, you don't have your energy is good, you don't have brain fog, you don't have skin rashes, your thyroid looks normal, which is a canary for autoimmune diseases, then I would say eat those bananas. I do food sensitivity testing, and I don't really like them. I don't think they're very accurate. And I had this poor guy that, you know, was just having a little problem with dementia, and, you know, coffee showed up on his as a high warning sign in his food sensitivity test. And so he agreed to go off of coffee for 6 weeks to see what your elimination diet, and see if he saw any changes, and he didn't. And then we put him back on coffee to see if he saw something that was adverse reaction to it, and he didn't. So at the end of the day, even though coffee